Hello, I'm Andrew, and welcome to this week's edition of the Black Country Talking News for the 13th of March, 2024.
Hello, and welcome to the Black Country Talking News, brought to you by the sight loss charity Beacons. We're pleased to confirm that the Talking News is now available via Alexa. Once you've enabled the Talking Newspapers skill, all you need to do is play Talking Newspapers and ask for the Black Country Talking News. Our Talking News service is also available via the free Wireless for the Blind app. It can be found on the Beacon Centre website, www.beaconvision.org/talking-news, as a podcast via services such as Apple or Spotify, or as a free CD. Simply contact Beacon Centre on 01902 880 111. We hope you enjoy this week's edition.
Reading for you this week, we have myself, Andrew, Angela, Ian, Christine, Helen, Mina, Simon, and of course, not forgetting, Flashback Roger. In this week's edition, we have the latest Beacon update from Helen. We have the nostalgia of the miners' strike and the latest news for the Black Country. We have the quiz with Mina, all the latest football news from Wolves and West Brom, a Did You Know section from Flashback Roger. We hear from Mina, who has all the weather for the weekend. And we also have another fabulous cook-along session in this edition for you too. Local news to start though with Ian, Christine, but first, Angela.
The Secretary of State for Energy Security and Net Zero visited Dudley to find out firsthand about Council's work to maximise energy from waste. Claire Coutinho visited Dudley Council's Energy from Waste plant on Lister Road with Dudley North MP Marco Longhi. The energy plant disposes of its household and trade waste to create energy, which the Council is looking to benefit from by selling it back to the national grid. The Council is also looking to use the energy to power its electric vehicles and Council buildings. During her visit, Ms. Coutinho was given a tour by Dudley Council's Waste Disposal Manager Mark Clinton. He said, "The energy plant takes all the household waste from Dudley Borough. We process anything up to 100,000 tonnes a year, with less than 1% going to landfill. The energy we generate is powered back into the grid and we produce around 36,000 megawatts every year, which equates to about 11,000 properties in that time." Ms. Coutinho said she was impressed by the waste plant. She added, "It was great to come and see local MP Marco Longhi in Dudley, where we visited a local waste plant. It was lovely to meet the team and I was particularly interested to hear about their successful trialling of electric bin lorries, which are helping to reduce emissions." Mr. Longhi said, "This method can potentially help the council reduce their demand on fuel and gas. That is a sensible and the right way of cutting costs and producing clean energy." Dudley Council's Cabinet Member for Climate Change, Councillor Rob Clinton, also joined the tour. He said, "This is an exciting and innovative project which shows our ambition to lead the way when it comes to tackling climate change. This is a focused area where several initiatives are being explored with a view to rolling out at scale in the future if they are successful." Urbaser Environmental Limited is contracted by Dudley Council to manage the day-to-day running of its Lister Road facility.
A solar farm which will power a city hospital for three quarters of the year is set to be up and running this spring. The Royal Wolverhampton NHS Trust, RWT, in partnership with Wolverhampton Council, has built the solar farm for New Cross Hospital at a former landfill site the size of 22 football pitches adjacent to Bentley Way in Wensfield and set to open in April. The facility will power the entire hospital site with self-generated renewable energy for around 288 days a year, which will save the Trust around £15 to £20 million over the next 20 years. It will produce 6.9 MWP of renewable energy to New Cross Hospital and will generate an estimated carbon saving of 1,583 tonnes of CO2e per annum. More than 15,000 electricity-generating solar panels have been installed at the site by main contractor Vital Energy, and work to secure the 40-plus acre brownfield site included protecting badger sets and removing methane. The project, combined with existing green technologies, allows the Trust to move away from reliance on the national grid and to reduce its exposure to rising electricity costs in the next two decades. It also supports the Trust's goal of reducing its carbon emissions by 25% by 2025 and of reaching net zero carbon emissions by 2040. Stu Watson, Director of Estates Development at RWT, said, "This investment is a huge boost to help us achieve that. Our primary focus is always on the patient, and these works ensure the Trust saves money on future energy bills, which we can then subsequently invest across other healthcare services." Professor David Loughton, CBE, Group Chief Executive at RWT, said, "As the largest employer in Wolverhampton, we take sustainability very seriously and are committed to continually working to reduce our carbon footprint. We have taken a number of steps to reduce and better manage our energy consumption and operate in a sustainable manner. One of these steps is to look at using renewable energy, so we are very pleased the development will be opening soon and delighted at the way the partnerships have worked out." Ashley Malin, Managing Director at Vital Energy, said, "We're delighted to have transformed a former coal mine and landfill site into this impressive solar farm, which is the largest single source of green energy on a hospital site within the UK. The clean energy will power the air source heat pumps within the hospital and significantly reduce the hospital's carbon footprint." During the council's climate change consultation, 82% of residents said they would welcome solar farms in Wolverhampton.
You may remember a previous article we shared about global electric car giant Tesla planning to build a major new regional hub in the Black Country. Well, you could say they already have, as children can now drive themselves to the operating theatres for surgery at Wolverhampton's New Cross Hospital. Two miniature Teslas have been donated to the Royal Wolverhampton NHS Trust charity and will be used to transport children to theatre as well as for their scans. The Tesla Owners Club UK donated the cars to make the experience of undergoing surgery less daunting for younger patients. One of the first patients to try out the shiny new wheels was 6-year-old Stanley Cochran, who was diagnosed with leukemia in December. Stanley, who is from Briley Hill, has to come into hospital frequently for procedures, blood transfusions, and appointments. He said, "I always get worried when I go for surgery, but now I won't feel as nervous by driving the car. I love how fast it is. Thank you so much for letting me drive one. It's brilliant." His dad, Lee Cochran, said he was thrilled to see the new cars. Lee added, "Something like this is right up his street. He has model cars and was watching car videos on YouTube earlier. He has his own toy Lamborghini he takes everywhere. So it's great for Stanley to be able to drive his own little car. I think it's a fantastic idea and will really help ease the nerves of the children going into surgery." Anthony Hugh Salomi from Tesla Owners Club said the donation was thanks to the generosity of the club members and the charity events they run. He added, "To give back to the community is fantastic, and a lot of fundraising has taken place to be able to make this donation. To bring a bit of fun into what can be a traumatic experience is what we aim to do with these cars." Kirsty Lewis, Acting Deputy Head of Nursing for Children's Services for RWT, said, "We are so grateful for the donation.
Being in hospital is never a nice experience for children, and little things like this can make it so much nicer for them. We hope it will get rid of some anxiety they get from being in hospital, and it will help make it a little bit more fun for them. Amanda Winwood, RWT Charity Development Manager, said, "Thank you so much to the Tesla Owners Club for the donation of the two cars. It's a fantastic gesture from the Tesla Owners Club, which will make a huge difference to the children we care for at the hospital and make their time with us that little bit brighter."
Up next, we hear from Helen, who, as usual, has our latest Beacon update.
Hi everyone, it's Helen from Beacon here, back with your weekly update, and we've got plenty of excitement for you this week because our Easter raffle is here and we've got a treat that really is larger than life. Picture this, a gigantic chocolate egg towering over 1 meter tall, that's right, 1 meter could be yours. Yeah, just imagine the sheer delight of cracking open that massive chocolate masterpiece. And the best part? Well, it's super easy to join in on the fun. Simply grab your ticket for just £1. And even if you don't snag the top prize, fear not, we've got an Easter hamper waiting for our lucky runner-up. So, are you ready to seize your chance at winning big? Head over to any of our shops or pop by our centre to get your ticket, or you can get one online at the following website, www.justgiving.com/page/Beacons Easter Raffle 2024. Now, if you're looking for another way to support Beacon, well, you can always join us on our annual colour run that takes place on Sunday, May the 12th at East Park in Wolverhampton. Join us for a colourful 5K experience where participants will be covered in bright powder as they make their way around the course. Best of all, your ticket purchase supports our work with blind and partially sighted individuals in our local community. Don't miss out on this unforgettable event that is fun for all the family. You can sign up at our website www.beaconvision.org/colour-run. Next, are you seeking support on your sight loss journey? Well, at the Beacon Centre for the Blind, our sight loss advice service is here to guide you every step of the way. Whether you're newly diagnosed or navigating life with sight loss, our team offers personalised advice, information and guidance that's tailored to your needs. From practical tips for daily living to emotional support and community resources, we're here to help you live well with sight loss, no matter where you are in your journey. To schedule an appointment, simply give us a call on 01902 880 111 or email inquiries@beaconvision.org. Now, last this week, it's recently been International Women's Day. So we have been celebrating the strength, resilience and achievements of women around the world, including those within our Beacon community. From staff members to volunteers, members and supporters, we're grateful for the incredible women who contribute to our mission of empowerment and inclusion for the visually impaired community. That's it for this week. I'll be back again soon with another update. Bye-bye.
Thanks a lot for that update, Helen. Up next, we have another block of local news.
With the ongoing transport projects and improvements being rolled out across the region, there are unfortunately plenty of roadworks and diversions for us to safely navigate on our streets. And this is set to get a little more disruptive for the Dudley area from this week. With the King Street and Flood Street Junction in Dudley set to close for 9 weeks to allow for the works for the Midlands Metro extension between Wensbury and Briley Hill. A spokesman for West Midlands Roads said, "Due to Metro extension work, the King Street and Flood Street Junction in Dudley will be closed from March the 11th for 9 weeks. Access to frontages as well as the Churchill Shopping Service Yard will still remain. And coinciding with this, advisory notices have also been released detailing how sections of Birmingham New Road are also set to be closed this weekend. A small section of the A4123 Birmingham New Road by the former Hanson's Ale Bridge between Burnt Tree and Tipton Road Junction will be closed to vehicles from 10 p.m. on Friday the 15th until 4 a.m. on Monday the 18th to allow the safe installation of the supporting beams for the Wensbury to Briley Hill Metro extension. The Wolverhampton bound lanes will be closed while one lane will remain open for traffic heading towards Birmingham. To facilitate these works, a diversion route for vehicles will be in place via Birmingham Road, while pedestrian access will be maintained at all times with designated crossing points in place. All local attractions and businesses remain open as usual for the duration of the works.
And whilst those road closures in Dudley may not be great fun, Wolverhampton residents are being encouraged to apply for temporary road closures in the hope that children will be able to play out safely in the street and have plenty of fun. Residents can apply to close their streets for up to 3 hours as part of the National Playing Out Scheme. Many youngsters may not have easy access to parks and open spaces, the council acknowledged. Councillor Jasbir Jaspal said, "Playing out days are a wonderful opportunity to give children free rein to play outside their homes in a healthy, safe and inclusive environment. They are days that will have a lasting, positive impression on children and their families." She added, "It can help to create a real sense of community, bringing neighbours of all ages and generations together and creating opportunities for them to socialise and build long-lasting connections. With the better weather now hopefully on the horizon, we encourage people to apply to hold their own playing out day. Among those who have organised playing out days in the past is Wolverhampton resident Kathy Allen. She said, "When I heard about playing out, I thought it would be ideal for Tythe Road as it's a cul-de-sac. We tend to theme our activities around occasions such as Halloween, Christmas and Easter. The whole community gets involved. We fund everything ourselves through donations and everyone pitches in on the day." Ms Allen said that residents had made playing out an important part of the Royal Street parties that were held to celebrate the Queen's Platinum Jubilee and the coronation of King Charles. "Playing out has had a brilliant impact on our community," she said. "We were always close-knit, but having playing out as a regular feature on our street has brought us even closer together." Any resident can apply for a temporary road closure. However, some roads within Wolverhampton may not be suitable. It is not possible to close main roads or roads which are on a bus route. Suitable roads include quiet residential streets or cul-de-sacs, but structures such as bouncy castles are not allowed. To find out more information and to get free advice and guidance about the playing out scheme, please contact City of Wolverhampton Council on
01902551155. A new project is looking to help those in the city who may be affected by issues linked to social isolation. Wildside Activity Centre is running a new project to help stop isolation among people across Wolverhampton. Wildside Activity Centre's Know Your Neighbourhood project aims to engage with people who may be at risk of loneliness due to feeling isolated from their surrounding communities. The scheme by the Wolverhampton-based Nature Reserve has already set up several groups and activities for people who would like the opportunity to engage more with others in and around their neighbourhoods. Elise Stewart, co-lead worker on the project, said, "There are many reasons why people can feel isolated within their communities. Age, issues around accessibility, a lack of immediate family or support networks, all of these factors can lead to a lack of engagement with the people and services around you. COVID led to many of us feeling extremely isolated, and for some, the issues they faced then are still being felt even now. The Know Your Neighbourhood project offers a range of activities for people to come and try their hand at, including crafts, quiz nights, a book club, and regular coffee mornings. At its core, however, the project is essentially reaching out to people and offering them a route to engaging more with others so that they start to feel less isolated and more confident in accessing other opportunities within their own communities. The majority of sessions being offered through the project take place at Wildside's Horndern Road Centre based at Whitmore Reans. As the project develops, it is envisaged more sessions can be held at other venues around Wolverhampton. The project is also looking into offering transport for those who may not otherwise be able to attend sessions. Co-project lead Andy Coulter said, "We know that the reasons for people feeling isolated are many and varied, so we want to be as flexible as possible in order to try and meet their needs. All our sessions are free of charge and people can get as involved as much or as little as they want to. So even if someone simply wants to come along and sit quietly for a cup of tea during one of our drop-ins, they are more than welcome." The Know Your Neighbourhood project has been established with funding from Heart of England and will run until April 2025. More information on the Know Your Neighbourhood project, including details of all activity sessions, can be found at wildside.ac.co.uk/know-your-neighbourhood/ or by calling Andy or Elise on 01902 754 612.
Now it's time to test your knowledge, as we have the quiz questions for this edition brought to us by Mina.
Hello and welcome to this week's flashback quiz. All the answers you need can be found later in Flashback Rogers' Did You Know feature. But for now, these are your questions. Here we go. Question 1. What is the smallest mammal called? Question 2. How long is an adult's circulatory system? Question 3. Which part of our body does not have any blood vessels? Question 4. How much of Earth's fresh water is thought to be accessible to us? Question 5. What was the deadly ingredient in many Victorian cosmetics? And finally, question 6. Why did a woman complain to police? I will be back with you later in the show to give you all the answers. But for now, best of luck!
Cheers for those questions, Mina. I'll get my mind working on them. Up now, however, is another block of local news.
Severn Trent has teamed up with Sikh Places of Worship in a potential world first to battle against sewer blockages and fatbergs. The water company is working with Gurdwaras to install kitchen traps to collect fats, oils and grease, fog, and there are plans to expand the initiative to Gurdwaras across the region, with more than 80 potentially set to sign up. Gurdwara kitchens are used by volunteers to cook and provide free meals to both the congregation and wider community. Severn Trent and contract partners Environmental Compliance and Services, ECAS, have linked up with Life Cycle Oils, LCO, and community group Gurdwara Aid, which called the scheme a potential world first. The scheme was launched this week at a Black Country Gurdwara, which has installed three of the fat traps. Gurdwara Aid spokesperson Harvinder Singh said, "This groundbreaking partnership joins Gurdwara Sahibs with Life Cycle Oils and Severn Trent to help keep our waterways and drains flowing. We feel the wider Sikh community will welcome this new undertaking as a valuable contribution to a cleaner environment. This joint venture, possibly the first of its kind anywhere in the world, demonstrates the power of collective responsibility. We are delighted to be working closely with the team from LCO and Severn Trent." Harkirat Kaur from ECAS represents Severn Trent as a community engagement officer and has been liaising with Gurdwaras with hopes of signing up many more across the Severn Trent region in coming weeks and months. She said, "The reaction from Gurdwaras to the fog traps has been very positive, and we are in discussions with many of them about signing up. Together, the Gurdwaras could have a huge environmental impact by helping prevent damage and costly fog blockages in our sewers." Kuldeep Singh Diol, a president of one of the Gurdwaras that has signed up to the scheme, said, "Recognising the environment and Mother Nature's sanctity is integral to the Sikh faith. Therefore, this project aligns perfectly with our values and will actively foster sustainability." Grant Mitchell, fog lead at Severn Trent, said, "This is a really innovative scheme where Gurdwaras can help the environment by collecting fats, oils and greases from their kitchens and congregation homes, which should never be flushed down sinks or drains. We know that fog can create costly blockages in our network, including fatbergs. This community-led scheme will help reduce them. The bonus is that Gurdwaras can also reap the financial benefits by creating additional income, as they can sell the used oil to Life Cycle Oils, who buy it back to create environmentally friendly energy as part of the agreement." He added, "As an added initiative, large branded tanks have been installed at the Gurdwaras to allow the congregation to bring their domestic recycled fat, oil and grease from home. This will help reduce the discharge of fog into the sewers, minimising blockages in the local community, whilst increasing the amount of fog the Gurdwara can collect."
Up next in this week's edition of the Black Country Talking News, we have another Bake Along session written and presented by Penny Melville Brown, who is also known as the Blind Baker. This Bake Along provides both the recipe and instructions in an entertaining and encouraging manner to bring the joy of home baking to all listeners, regardless of their level of sight. So, ready or not, here it crumbs.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Hello, I'm Penny Melville Brown, the Blind Baker. I won an international prize that enabled me to cook all round the world. I've written all the recipes up. I've made hundreds of videos and I blog and write about recipes all the time. There's even a cookbook. You can find out more about me at www.pennymelvillebrown.com. Hello, it's Penny Melville Brown again. And after all the cold snaps we've had recently, I thought a good winter warming soup, just what we needed. And I love this one because it's incredibly simple. It makes about suppers for about 6 days for one person or three for two, and it's delicious. So all you need actually is a saucepan, cooking oil in, and then afterwards, either a hand blender you can put into the pan to blend it up a bit, or you can put some of it into a proper jug blender. Worst case scenario, if you haven't got either, you just chop your onions and your mushrooms as fine as you can, and it'll still come out wonderful. So let me start off with the ingredients. 2 medium-sized onions, peeled and finely chopped into little dice, I think. Then you want 90 grams of butter and 500 grams of mushrooms. And again, those need to be trimmed and sliced. I never wash mushrooms. It just makes them wet because they absorb all the water. You want a good tablespoon of fresh thyme leaves, or if you haven't got any in the garden, a smaller amount of dried thyme leaves would be good. Then we need some liquid, and I'm just going to use 1 litre of water and one of those little plastic containers of stock, a stock pot or a stock cube, or if you're really good, you can use 1 litre of your own homemade water, stock. I would use chicken stock, but it's not going to be that important. Then you want cream to taste. I'd think a couple of tablespoons. And you also want some salt and pepper to taste. And you're also looking for 20 grams of corn flour or plain flour, just to thicken it all up a bit. It's an incredibly easy recipe. So we're just going to throw diced up onions into the pan with the butter and gently saute them for about 8 to 10 minutes. We're looking for them to start smelling. I wouldn't be able to see if they were getting golden, but I would be able to feel on the end of the spoon whether they're getting soft. Then you throw in all the mushrooms, all sliced up, and the thyme. And mushrooms make a lot of bulk when they go into the pan, so you need a reasonably good-sized pan. And then you just sauté them, nothing more complicated, for probably about another 8 minutes until they all start collapsing down. At that stage, in goes the corn flour. You just sprinkle it across the top, and that's just going to mix in with your mushrooms before you pour in the 1 litre of water, put in your stock cube, and then you bring the whole lot up to a gentle simmer, probably, again, another 8 to 10 minutes, not much more. Finally, you add some cream to taste, and I recommended a couple of tablespoons, and then your salt and pepper to taste. There you go. A dead simple winter warming mushroom soup that you can have at home or you can offer to your guests. Really lovely. I hope you enjoy this recipe. I hope you give it a try. If you've got ideas or suggestions for future recipes, please get in touch with me. You can always make contact through my website, www.pennymelvillebrown.com. And happy baking to all of you too. Bye-bye.
DNF Soundings.
Now then, with thanks to Mark Andrews of the Express and Star, the Black Country Talking News brings a major new series looking back at the dispute and our region's part in it. Miners' Strike 40 Years On, Episode 2.
In 1981, the Thatcher government announced proposals to close 23 pits, in a break with the plan for coal, which had previously been agreed with the union. a strike ballot resulted in an 87.6% vote in favour of a walkout, prompting Thatcher to back down. Gormley called off the strike, but many miners defied him and held an unofficial walkout anyway. Gormley turned 65 in 1982, and the previous year an election was held for his successor. It was no great secret that Gormley feared a takeover by the far left, and some years earlier he had introduced age restrictions on the role of president to ensure that communist rival Mick McGahey would never be able to succeed him. But if Gormley thought he had seen off the threat from the left, he would be in for a rude awakening. By spiking the guns of his old rival, Gormley merely opened the door to the young pretender. Scargill won the election with more than 70% of the vote, and Gormley later admitted he regretted not seeing the threat that Scargill posed. "I didn't realise it at the time, but I let a monster out of the bottle," he said. Scargill made little secret of the fact he was cut from a very different cloth to his predecessor, and spoke openly about his time as chairman of Yorkshire's Communist Youth League and his role on the organisation's executive committee. Many believed that the weight of high office would be a calming influence, but this quickly proved to be wishful thinking, and within months of the vote, he was calling for a strike after the government offered miners a 9.3% pay rise. A strike was only avoided when Gormley stepped in and urged members to accept the pay offer. With a self-confessed militant now in charge of one of the country's most powerful union and a prime minister braced for a showdown, it looked likely it was only a matter of time before the two would clash. Warning shots were fired when the NUM balloted its members for national strikes in January 1982, October 1982, and March 1983, but on each occasion, members voted against action. When the NCB offered a pay rise of 5.2% in November 1983, the union imposed an overtime ban on its members.
Enter into the fray new coal boss Ian McGregor. In 1977, in an attempt to revive the nationalised car manufacturer British Leyland, the then Labour Prime Minister Jim Callaghan headhunted Scottish-American industrialist McGregor. The initial plan was for him to serve as a deputy chief to executive Michael Edwards, but it quickly became clear he would not be content with a merely strategic role. McGregor claimed to be the man who sacked Derek Red Robbo Robinson, a militant union convener at the company's Longbridge branch, although accounts differ about this. His hardline, no-nonsense stance had not gone unnoticed by the new Thatcher government, and in 1980, Secretary of State for Industry Sir Keith Joseph appointed him chairman of British Steel. After inheriting a company that was costing the taxpayer £1.8 billion a year in losses, McGregor turned the business round to profitability, but this came on the back of a ruthless plant closure programme and the loss of 90,000 jobs. His legacy was certainly divisive. When McGregor was appointed head of the National Coal Board in 1983, controversy was inevitable. The government hoped he would do for the coal industry what he had done for British Steel and make it profitable in the face of falling demand. But that would inevitably mean the closure of unprofitable pits, which had been shutting at an alarming rate since the Second World War. Scargill's contempt for McGregor was clear from the outset, and he was clearly up for a battle. "Waiting in the wings, wishing to chop us to pieces, is Yankee Steel Butcher McGregor," he wrote in Union magazine The Miner. "This 70-year-old multimillionaire import, who massacred half the steel workforce in less than 3 years, is almost certainly brought in to wield the axe on pits. It's now or never for Britain's mine workers. This is the final chance, while we still have the strength, to save our industry." McGregor replied that he was a plastic surgeon whose role was to try to rebuild damaged features. He riled miners in Scargill's native Yorkshire by telling them that they were less productive than female miners in the US. When McGregor visited Ellington Colliery in February 1984, he was wrestled to the ground. It was a taste of what was to follow. While the NUM's successes in the 1970s had catapulted miners to the top of the public pay league, the industry had been in freefall since Clement Attlee made the wartime nationalisation permanent in 1946. The shift from steam to diesel power on the railways was a major factor in the fall in demand, and the discovery of natural gas in the North Sea also meant far less coal was needed for domestic heating. In 1946, the NCB was responsible for 958 collieries, but by 1971, this had fallen to 292. The workforce halved between 1958 and 1967, but the rationalisation had taken place in cooperation with the union at a time of low unemployment.
By 1984, many of the older pits had largely been worked out, and the coal was becoming increasingly hard to extract. MacGregor sought to counter this by investment in new technology, but this inevitably meant job losses at a time when 3 million were out of work. And then, on March 5, 1984, MacGregor dropped the bombshell. He proposed cutting production by 4 million tonnes a year, with the closure of 20 pits and the loss of 20,000 jobs. Scargill said the government had a long-term strategy to close more than 70 pits, a claim which was denied by ministers. MacGregor wrote to every NUM member, claiming Scargill was deceiving them and there were no plans to close any more pits than had already been announced. However, cabinet papers released in 2014 indicate that MacGregor wished to close 75 pits over a three-year period. The big shock, though, came with the timetable of MacGregor's plan. Five pits, Coulton Wood and Bullcliff Wood near Wakefield, Herrington in County Durham, Snowdown in Kent and Polmaze in Scotland, were earmarked for closure within 5 weeks. Miners at Coulton Wood and Bullcliff Wood voted for an immediate walkout, supported by colleagues at Manvers, Cadderby, Silverwood, Kiverton Park and Yorkshire Main, who declared an unofficial walkout. The following day, flying pickets from Yorkshire travelled south to Nottinghamshire, forcing Harworth Colliery to shut. On March 12th, Scargill declared NUM support for regional strikes in Yorkshire and Scotland and urged NUM members across the country to walk out in solidarity. But crucially, he declined to hold a national ballot. While the NUM branches of Yorkshire, Scotland and Kent were known to be hotbeds of union militancy, the coalfields of the Midlands were perceived to be more moderate. It therefore came as something of a surprise when Midland area president Joe McKee urged 12,200 West Midlands miners to join the strike at a meeting in Stafford. However, Mr. McKee said no strike would take place until a vote had been held, and he urged pickets from outside the area to stay away until a decision had been made. He was backed by 2,000 miners at Lee Hall in Rugeley, one of the region's biggest pits, who said they would cross any picket lines which tried to stop them from working until a ballot had been held. Striking miners in Cannock area received £500 after a personal plea to steel union leader Bill Sirs in September 1984. Branch Secretary Tony Morris said, "We'll work normally until we have either a national ballot, preferably, or an area ballot, even if it means crossing picket lines." A ballot of miners in the West Midlands was held on March 13th and 14th, with 27% voting in favour of strike action, less than half the required 55% to make the strike official. Scenes of intimidation by flying pickets in Nottinghamshire were believed to have been a major influence on the vote. On March 15th, Littleton Colliery at Cannock was shut down by flying pickets. The next day, Scargill turned up to Littleton in person, addressing 1,000 miners. Regional leader Joe McKee, who had earlier in the week urged miners to back the strike, told Scargill to call off his pickets. "I have told him straight in public that our men are disturbed by the ugly scenes in Nottingham," he said. "They want the National Executive recalled and a national ballot. I have also appealed to him to use his influence in other areas to persuade them not to send pickets to Staffordshire. We can look after ourselves." Scargill claimed the men he had spoken to at Littleton had pledged their full backing. He warned them that 40% of pits in the Midlands could go in the closures. "I am delighted that members in this part of the world are prepared to back the union's policy on pit closures," he said. Scargill said he did not expect any violence outside the pits in Staffordshire, but denied that his men were responsible for the clashes in Nottinghamshire.
Meanwhile, the government were looking at ways to counteract the tactics of the union. Stung by Heath's defeat by the miners in 1974, right-wing MP Nicholas Ridley spent the following years drawing up a detailed strategy of how a future Conservative government would handle such a dispute. The so-called Ridley Plan, published in 1977, recommended that coal stocks should be built up at power stations to ensure the electricity supply would be maintained. Haulage companies should be encouraged to recruit non-unionised drivers, and contingency supplies of coal from overseas should be identified. He also called for power stations to be equipped with generators that could run on either oil or coal, reducing dependency on a single type of fuel. And police should be trained in riot tactics to uphold the law against violent picketing. The plan had been meticulously implemented during the first term of the Thatcher government, and by the time the strike broke out, ministers were fully prepared. Calling the strike at the end of winter was also seen by critics as something of a tactical blunder, with the warmer weather reducing demand for coal in the crucial early months of the dispute. The lack of a national vote and the ugly clashes on the picket lines made it hard for the miners to win the hearts and minds of the general public. The media coverage was also less than sympathetic. Scathing reports in The Sun, The Daily Mail and The Telegraph was par for the course, but the ferocious condemnation from the solidly pro-Labour Daily Mirror and the left-leaning Guardian would have come as a blow. Labour leader Neil Kinnock, who in private detested Scargill, was at best lukewarm in his support for the cause. Any miners who didn't realise they were in for a long, hard slog would have their doubts quickly dispelled. Up next, it's trivia time, brought to us by Flashback Roger and his Did You Know feature. Take it away, Roger.
Hello again, everyone. Well, I hope they're all as well as can be and ready for another round of interesting but odd facts to make us say, "Well, who'd have thought it?" In a road up. Let's go with these nuggets of wisdom. So, did you know that? The bumblebee bat is the world's smallest mammal, weighing in at just 0.05 to 0.07 ounces, with a head-to-body length of 1.14 to 1.29 inches and a wingspan of 5.1 to 5.7 inches. The bumblebee bat is also known as Kitty's hognose bat. It's the smallest mammal in the world, according to the Guinness Book of Records anyway. And our body's circulatory system is astonishing. If a child's entire circulatory system were to be laid out flat, it would stretch for more than 60,000 miles, that's according to the Franklin Institute, and by the time we reach adulthood, our bodies have become home to approximately 100,000 miles of blood vessels. And the cornea is only one of two parts of the human body without blood vessels. Cornea is the clear part of the eye that covers the pupil and other parts of the eye, whilst cartilage and the cornea are the only types of tissue in the human body that do not contain blood vessels. That's according to scientists at the Harvard University's Department of Ophthalmology. And us human beings can use only a small fraction of the Earth's water. In school, we were taught that most of the planet's surface is covered in water. While that's true, humans can only use 0.07% of that water, that's according to the National Geographic. That's because only 2.5% of Earth's water is fresh water. and only 1% of that is accessible. The rest makes up glaciers and snowfields. And you've probably heard about how lots of Victorians' favourite cosmetics were riddled with arsenic, but it gets worse. There were also products on the market in the late 19th century, like Dr. James P. Campbell's Safe Arsenic Complexion Wafers, that were meant to be eaten. They claim to get rid of freckles, blackheads and other facial disfigurements. Whatever you do, folks, though, don't ever try this one at home. And finally, a woman called the police when her ice cream didn't have enough sprinkles. The West Midlands Police in England released a recording of a woman who dialed 999 because she said there were bits on one side of her ice cream cone and none on the other. She was even more upset when the ice cream truck man didn't want to give her her money back. Well, I think that's shameful. Well, so there you have it for this week, folks, and I hope that you've digested it ready for our quiz later. Ooh, talking about digesting, I'm as dry as chip, so I'll make myself a nice cuppa and have a couple of three chalky digestives this time. Till next week, then, I'll say bye for now. Ta-ra a bit. Ta-ra.
Up now we have to hear what the weather has in store for us. Brought to us, come rain or shine, by our own Sunny Mina.
The weather for this week ahead is forecast to remain unsettled, with plenty of showers and with a gentle breeze coming up from the south. Temperatures should become a little milder too. UV levels are expected to remain low. The sunrise and sunset times are 6:10 a.m. for the sunrise and 6:25 p.m. for the sunset. Friday 15th of March is forecast to have wet start to the day, with a chance of sunny intervals breaking through in the afternoon. With a gentle southerly breeze, temperatures are forecast to be mild at around 14 degrees. Moving on, and an unsettled wet spell of weather looks set to continue in the weekend, with Sunday providing the best chance of some drier sunny spells. With the winds continuing to drive up from the south, a breezy weekend also means temperatures will remain mild at 14 degrees. On to next week, where the spell of wet weather will continue to dominate once again, with plenty of light rain and drizzle hanging around. It is forecast for rain to remain in the region on Monday 18th of March and continue right through to Thursday 21st of March. With lighter winds coming in from the south, temperatures are forecast to remain in double digits all week, with high of 12 degrees. So, there we have it, another mixed bag of sunshine and showers to accompany us through all of next week. As always, do take care and enjoy the weather.
Cheers for that weather update, Mina. Now it's time to find out how our local football teams have been getting on.
Wolves recovered from two more injury blows with a magnificent second half display to register a 2-1 win over Fulham. Jean Rigner, Bellegarde and Pedro Neto both came off in a disastrous first 45 for the hosts. But Wolves rallied with a fast start to the second half as Rayan Aynouri netted just 7 minutes after the restart. Wolves remained in control of the game and scored a second when Nelson Semedo's shot took a huge deflection. Alex Iwobi flicked home a 98th minute goal, but Wolves held on to keep themselves firmly in the race for European football. With Bellegarde going down with a knee complaint within the opening 10 minutes, before Neto pulled up with a hamstring strain just before half-time, it now leaves Wolves with Pablo Sarabia as their only remaining senior forward, with Hwang Hee-chan and Mateus Cunha also sidelined. Speaking openly after the game, Gary O'Neill confirmed both Neto and Bellegarde required further scans to diagnose the extent of their injuries, and also spoke extensively about the complexities of matchday selection with such a threadbare squad currently. "It's hard for the medical team. They come and speak to me, and then I come and tell you what they think, but there's a lot of work that will need to be done." Neto had a really good week. He had a scan that was completely clear with no muscle damage at all, and he felt really good in training. I'm really disappointed. It lands on me eventually whether the decision to play him was right or not, so one that I have to accept. I'm devastated for Pedro. He's worked so hard to get back. We're hopeful, and the medical team don't think it's anything like his first one, but there will be a scan and we'll get the results and go from there. Neto came off at halftime against Newcastle the week before with a tight hamstring on his left leg, but was deemed fit to face Fulham before suffering his injury to the same leg. Earlier in the season, Neto missed 8 weeks with a hamstring injury on his right leg. Now O'Neill has expressed some regret at playing Neto, but insists that Wolves did their due diligence before making a decision. He came off against Newcastle with a tight hamstring and missed a few days, but then he felt good, O'Neill added. We didn't want to just risk him off the back of him feeling good, so we sent him for a scan and got a couple of opinions on the scan. It was deemed perfect, and there was nothing wrong with the hamstring at all. I went in on the lad's day off to work with him on his own on Thursday to see where he was, and we did some really good work. He seemed okay and was better again on Friday. Everyone was telling me he was fine and there's no reason not to play him. But maybe with my playing experience, maybe if I had the team sheet back again now, of course, I'm not putting Pedro's name on it. Those are the decisions you have to make as a manager. If that's my fault, then I apologise to Pedro and the group that we'll be without him for a little while. But we did do a lot of work on trying to reach the right decision, and unfortunately it backfired on us. Despite those injury blows, Wolves went on to put in a strong second half performance and secure all 3 points at Molineux to stay in the hunt for European football. It's an unbelievable win. My favourite, I think, O'Neill said. In terms of what we've had to deal with, our position before the game and our position during the game, to find a way to beat a Fulham team who are in a really good moment. They're so strong depth-wise. They have like-for-like players on their bench, an unbelievable bench, and we're in a different moment. We can be as strong as that, but at this moment we're not. Mentally, for the players to lose a couple of attacking players and still be able to find a way to respond means it's an unbelievable win. I'm delighted. With a few big weeks ahead, Wolves will be hoping for more favourable fortunes, beginning with the quarter-final of the FA Cup against Coventry this weekend. And a rampant Albion came from behind to win for the first time this season, as 4 goals in 22 second-half minutes completed a ruthless turnaround at lowly Huddersfield Town. In grim conditions at the John Smith Stadium and in front of a fairly lifeless Sunday lunchtime atmosphere, there was little to write home about from the first half as Carlos Corberan's side delivered one of their poorest 45 minutes in memory. On the head coach's first return to the John Smith Stadium, the Baggies were deservedly behind at the interval. But the Spaniard inspired his troops at the break and Albion didn't look back. As if a switch had been flicked, the visitors' transformation after the break was staggering, from the worst half of the season to one of the best. Corberan's men suddenly gave the home defenders something to think about, after a first half of 0 shots against the drop zone Terriers. They returned energised and playing with a purpose and a clear plan, moving the ball forward quicker to turn the home defenders. It was smart tactics that exposed the home team's frailties and brought about the equaliser just 7 minutes after the restart, through the first of Mikey Johnston's double. The returning Kyle Bartley scrambled in a key second on the hour before the Baggies scored an important third, and in stunning style. Johnston embarked on a typical surging run from left to right, but a heavy final touch saw the ball roll perfectly and invitingly into the path of Yokuzlu. The Turkey international needed no second invitation to unleash a missile towards the left corner that kept rising until it flew high beyond Nichols. It was unstoppable and a goal of the season contender. Celtic lone star Johnston saw out the clash with his second, a sixth goal in 7 games, as rampant Albion cantered to a first win in Huddersfield since 2010. After the game, Carlos Corberan was thrilled to see his half-time tactical switch pay off so quickly as Albion roared back to dispatch Huddersfield. The head coach explained how he told his players to look to stretch Huddersfield and to play behind the Terriers' midfield and back line, rather than in front of them with short passes, and the tweak led to 4 goals in 22 ruthless minutes. I think sometimes you need to understand the needs of the game. The type of game Huddersfield proposed was man-to-man every time the ball was with our keeper. We knew this. It's not something new. Without any doubt, it was key to score quickly, because sometimes when you start to spend time trying to find the solution, you can lose the right mentality and the opponent can commit things to change what you try to do. The game can be more complicated with the passing of the minutes. That's why I was happy with the immediate reaction of the players to the second half and the managing of the game. It is the first time Albion have been unbeaten in 5 away games since the start of Valerian Ismail's tenure, as a 5-point gap to the 7th was once again opened up with 9 games left.
Now, here come the quiz
answers,
and they're brought to us by Mina.
Hello, and here are your answers for this week's flashback quiz. Feeling confident? How will you score? Let's see. Question 1. What is the smallest mammal called? The answer? The bumblebee bat. Question 2. How long is adult's circulatory system? And the answer here is an unbelievable 100,000 miles. Question 3. Which part of our body does not have any blood vessels? And the answer here is the eye's cornea and any cartilage. Question 4. How much of Earth's fresh water is thought to be accessible to us? And the answer? Just 1%. Question 5. What was the deadly ingredient in many Victorian cosmetics? And the answer? It was arsenic. Question 6. Why did a woman complain to police? And the answer? Because she didn't get enough sprinkles on her cone of ice cream. Did you get them all right? If not, not to worry, as I will be back next week to test you all once again. Bye for now.
So that's it for another edition of the Black Country Talking News. A reminder to our CD listeners who have received CDs in padded envelopes that you don't need to send anything back to us. If you have a sight loss tip or someone you would like to wish a happy birthday to, just say hello to. Maybe even a poem or talking book you would like reviewed, then please get in touch with us at the Beacon Centre. Call 01902 880111. Email bctn@beaconvision.org or write to us at the Black Country Talking News, Beacon, Wolverhampton Road East, Wolverhampton, WV4 6AZ. We look forward to hearing from you. Thank you for listening, and thank you to all our supporters, donators and volunteers who, without their support, we would be unable to run this free service. Please note, the information and views expressed in this recording does not necessarily represent the views of Beacon or Talking News and were accurate at the time of recording. Mentions of goods and services does not imply endorsement, and whilst every care is taken to supply accurate information, Beacon and Talking News do not undertake liability for any errors. So it's goodbye from all of us, stay safe, have a good week, and we look forward to bringing you next week's edition of the Black Country Talking News. Ta-ra!